sense of self-aggrandizement. We want to thank the Dumont family for sponsoring this this Dumont University, the Mary Hytken Dumont University, and we want to thank everyone for coming tonight. And our topic is our relationship to the whole world around us. So tonight we're going to discuss our relationship to Christianity. Then we'll move right into Islam the following week. It's a controversial topic. And then we'll be looking at our relationship to ethical humanism, and our relationship to globalism and solving the problems of the world around us, and our approach to tikkun olam and global issues such as that. So, so without any further ado, let's get started with our relationship to Christianity. The title on top of the page doesn't quite fit, but we'll see. So, if there's any problem, we'll go into the next room. Okay. So, in evaluating any religion, the first question always is, but we're actually going to get to that a little later, but one of the main questions is its relationship to paganism. In other words, in the Torah, there was sort of a binary system. There were pagan faiths where they worshipped idols, and then there was Judaism where we didn't worship idols. And the problem is that Christianity, in particular, and Islam less so, fall in somewhere in that spectrum between paganism, a polytheism where there's more than just a simple Hashem Echad, God is one, period. On the other hand, they also claim to be an ethical monotheism, and exactly how that all works out together, that'll be part of what we'll discuss tonight. But I thought before we could discuss our relationship to Christianity and whether we thought it was paganism or wasn't paganism. Good evening, come on in. A couple extra chairs right there. We also have hooks over here if you'd like. For your coats. Before we discuss whether Jews and rabbis over the centuries considered it paganism or didn't consider it paganism, let's deal with a more fundamental question of a relationship of Judaism and Christianity in terms of how do we see the original story of Jesus? How does Jesus make his appearance in the Talmud? How does he do and how does he come out in the Talmud? If you need extra chairs in the room next door, which is open, there are extra chairs. Okay. Thank you. Okay, great. Welcome. So firstly, a passage in the Talmud, in Sanhedrin 107a. So here's a story of Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya and his student Yeshu. Now, the problem is Yeshu usually means Jesus. The problem is that Yeshua ben Prachya lived about 100 years before Jesus. So it's kind of strange to say that this is a story about Jesus, but there were a lot of people named Jesus in our tradition. For instance, Josephus talks about different high priests and things. A lot of them were named Jesus. So we have a problem in pinning him down. But perhaps what was more important than whether this story is about the historical Jesus is whether how Jews thought about Jesus, and this is one of the stories that made people think a certain way about him. And the story is told that they had to be in Alexandria in Egypt. He and this great Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya, the great sage of that era, and the fellow said that I deduce. He says he came to the lodge. They came to the motel there, and he said he prayed. How beautiful is this lodging? You know, this place is beautiful. But in Aramaic, the relationship between the hostess of the house and the lodge itself was ambiguous. So he took it as a reference to not to the lodge, but to the lodge keeper, to the innkeeper, that the rabbi was commenting on the looks of the innkeeper. So he said, well, but her eyes are misshaped. Third line from the bottom of the first paragraph. Her eyes are misshaped. Well, what do you mean she's beautiful? Her eyes are misshaped. So the rabbi, who that was the farthest thing from his mind, he didn't intend to comment on the beauty of or lack thereof of the innkeeper. He was just talking about the inn. And he said, evil one, and this is what you're busy with. He brought forth 400 chauffeurs and excommunicated him. So they excommunicated this fellow. So here, how is this fellow portrayed? If Jews were brought up thinking, oh, this is Jesus of the Christian Testament. If that's indeed true, there are chairs next door. Sorry about that. So they were thinking of him as what? As this outside character? What is he? What's his relationship to our community? Whose student is he? What is he? He's a student of this big rabbi, Rabbi Shua ben Prachya. He's inside the community. So this is one vision of him. It's a Pharisaic Jew, a rabbinic Jew who values the rabbis, who's studying with the rabbis, and then he goes astray. There's something illegitimate about him. There are other Talmudic passages that say that they call him the son of this person, son of that person. So who was his real father? Well, this was his supposed father, but he was some sort of a bastard or something, meaning that his mother slept with a man other than her husband, and that's why he had two father names. He was Ben this and Ben that, because one was his sort of supposed father, one was his real father. So there are many disparaging statements about a Jesus of sorts. If you look at the end of this story in Taviat Firenze, an Italian collection of Jewish manuscripts. If you look at these lines, listen to the lines, and it includes the last line in the English here. This text tells us this previous story slightly differently, but it ends like this. Amar lo chazor b'cha. He told him, do tshuva, repent. Amar lo, so the Jesus said to the rabbi, Kach mukublani mimcha, I have a tradition from you, rabbi. Kolachote umachti zarabim, anybody who sins and makes other people sin, ain't maspikim b'yadol lasas tshuva. You can never do tshuva. If you make other people sin, you can never do tshuva. So somehow this story presumes that Jesus had already led people astray, and he could never go back. The Amar Mar, and we learned, now the narrator comes into the Talmud and he says, Yeshu HaNotri, Jesus the Nazarene. Now what that means is hard to say. City of Nazareth was not mentioned in rabbinic literature or anything until about 900. So does it mean something else? Maybe it means Netzer, the one who sprouts forth. It's an allusion to the Messiah, as from a verse from Isaiah. Anyway, Yeshu HaNotri, Kishef, he was an idol worshiper. I mean, a black magic magician. Be'sit, be'diach Israel. He deceived and led Israel astray, for which there's no repentance. So, again, historically, this story is in the wrong era. It's not about Jesus. It's about someone who lived before that. Or maybe it's a bad memory. They remembered that there was someone named Jesus, but they associated him with Rabbi Shua ben Prachya, who lived earlier. They should have associated him with other rabbis who lived later. But in their vision of him, he was a kishef. Kishef, we're going to come back to this later. He was a witchcraft. If you associate him with the witchcraft, that means that you believe that he...
was a witch.
Witch, in other words, but the assumption, what's the positive assumption? The negative assumption is a witch. But what's the positive assumption?
He has
powers. That he did have powers. You see, if you ask a yeshiva boy, pull the boy out of yeshiva and say, excuse me, did Jesus do any miracles? They say, no, nonsense. No any miracles. That's Christians believe that. We don't, right? But if you say kishev, that means we accept the idea that he performed wonders, and we say he was a witch. Or in other sources that he used the divine name. There's a way of doing tricks using the divine name. So, what do we have so far? We alluded to a passage, not here on your sheet, that the rabbis associate his lineage as very weak, or as the Christian scriptures try to associate him with being a son of David, and they make up a whole genealogy. The rabbis associate him with having not being the son of God, but on the contrary, being the son of an adulterer. And they have him as some sort of a witch, someone who deceived Israel, but also as a student of the rabbis. Here's another story where he appears in a certain way, and we'll take a look at it. There's a strange story about Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer is huge. Rabbi Eliezer is one of the two main teachers of Rabbi Akiva. So he's huge. He's Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, the great Rabbi Eliezer. Strangely enough, he had some sort of debate with the other rabbis, and he was in the minority, and he wouldn't give in, and they kind of excommunicated him, and he landed out being living his end of his days in excommunication. And then the Romans apparently imprisoned him for heresy. So he said, how did I get into this? What am I doing? Well, how did God see to it that I am accused of heresy? I mean, of all things, accuse me of studying too much Torah, you know, guilty, you know, not spending enough time with my wife and kids, guilty, but accuse me of heresy? I've been a rabbi my whole life. What kind of nonsense is this? So his student, Rabbi Akiva, who always tried to make you feel better, and he's like a psychologist, social worker, he says, well, perchance, in the middle of the paragraph in the bottom, perchance you have once given your ear to heresy? Maybe once you were listening to something and you listened to some heresy which pleased you, you listened to something heretical, and you said, ooh, that's a good idea. And on that account, you've been arrested for heresy. Because you once enjoyed a good piece of heresy, therefore, that's maybe why God is having it that they're accusing you of heresy. So he said, Akiva, you reminded me. I was once walking in the upper streets of Sepphoris. Sepphoris is Tzipori. It's a wonderful city. You can go there today. Some of us have been there. If you go there, it's right near Nazareth. And you can go there, and they have these magnificent rooms with mosaic tiles and different walkways. You can see the street. It was a big, big city of Jews, Christians, Romans. And there was an upper city and a lower city. It was a big city. There I met one of the disciples of Jesus the Nazarene, Jacob of Kfar Shechnaya. Now, apparently, the word Nazareth doesn't appear, but the Kfar Shechnaya and a different Kfar, there are different names that appear of different cities where he's associated with, not Bethlehem. Bethlehem's in the south. Most rabbinic Jews are up in the north. Anyway, but obviously the Christian scriptures are trying to make him of Bethlehem. Anyway, because that would make him of David and all that, which is nonsense, because even if someone lived in the era of in the city of Bethlehem in Jesus' times, that there was discontinuity. They weren't necessarily there since the days of David, right? There was an exile in between. So people who lived in Bethlehem were not people who came from David's family or something like that. So in any event. So he said to me, it's found in your law, thou shalt not bring a hire of a whore into the house of God. So what do you do if the prostitute has some money? What does she do with that money? What can be done with it? May your latrine for the high priest be built out of such gifts. The high priest needs a latrine in the temple. So you want to take the money that came from a harlot, which you can't give to the temple, but maybe you could give it to the latrine in the temple. That was the question that supposedly a disciple of Jesus asked this question, and I answered him nothing. He said to me, thus had Jesus the Nazarene taught me, for a hire of a whore had she gathered him, unto the hire of a whore should she return, from the place of filth they come, the place of filth she should go. What seems to be the answer? No?
Yes,
right. The money is filthy money, can go back to the latrine, the perfect solution. So that's what Jesus taught this fellow Jacob, who we may know from other connections that we don't. This explanation pleased me. The rabbi Eliezer, back to Eliezer, he liked that explanation. On account of this, I've been arrested for heresy. So again, if indeed this is Jesus that we all know, then how does Jesus appear here? As a teacher, a preacher. Is he doing rabbinic stuff? Is he handling sort of rabbinic material and making midrash and answering shailas and different questions and stuff like that? Right. So he would appear as like a some describe him as a fallen rabbi or something like that. So that would support that sort of view of him. There's a parallel story of this story about Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yezer that's found in the Tosefta. That's an outside source, outside the Mishnah and outside the Talmud. But it's more or less the same story. And there, if you look in the third line, the last word is Tzipori on the left. And then it says, Matzati Yaakov Ishkvar Sechanya Va'amar Davar Shalminus Mishem Yeshua ben Pantira. Pantira, Pandora, there's all kinds of theories as to what his name was. Again, I'm on the 4 lines from the top, 3 words from the end. It says Yeshua ben Pantira. So there it is. Now, in modern editions of the Tosefta, of the Talmud, it doesn't say, since printing has been made, Jews were smart enough not to print a book that had things that were against Christianity. There were censors. I have some, my dad, Alva Shalom, had some books at home. You know, and on the front page it says, this book has been officially reviewed and there's nothing contrary to Christianity. And we took out references to Jesus. So in the regular book, it mentions Rabbi Jacob who learned from a certain heretic, but it doesn't say who the heretic was. The word heretic, we're going to come back to later, that Christianity was viewed as a heresy. The word heresy is minut. Is usually refers to people who are Jewish. If you're a non-Jew and you believe in paganism or something, you're not a heretic, you're an idol worshiper, an akum. So we'll come back to that later about the idea of Christianity being a type of heresy. So again, there are some very disparaging stories about his lineage, about his being a witch of some sort. We'll come back to that. There are stories, on the other hand, that he was somehow a teacher, somehow connected to certain rabbis. Some of the periods in which which he's associated with don't sound like they line up. Can Rabbi Akiva, who's living in the Bar Kokhba period, 160 or so, can he be listening to can his rabbi be listening to a man who heard the preachings of Jesus in the year 60? You know, does that work out, or does it line up? So there are questions about that. Is the Jesus of the Talmud the real Jesus, or is it just some other kind of Jesus type of figure? Were there a lot of Jesus figures running around? And so these are questions one can ponder. There was one very brazen Jewish historian who thought that Jesus never existed, but the general assumption is that he existed and that the rabbis allude to him here, there, and the other place. For instance, now later on, in later generations, do they continue to make reference to Christianity? So there are allusions here and there. Rabbi Abahu lived in a very Roman city. He lived in Caesarea, which was a very Roman city. They said it was a dangerous place. You had to make a prayer going in and prayer going out if you could survive being there. And here and there, Rabbi Abahu makes comments that sound like he's thinking about Christianity. For instance, who would like to read that? Jerusalem Talmud. Ooh, I forgot to mention where it was from. I believe it's in Brachos. I have to double check that. In any event, who would like to read that for us?
I will.
Go ahead.
Jerusalem Talmud, to Rabbi Abahu says, if a person says to you, I am a God, he is lying. If he says, I am a person very righteous and holy.
Now, the person, Ben Adam. Ben Adam is an expression used in Ezekiel. God always calls man, Ben Adam, son of man. And somehow son of man morphed into son of something else later on, but not in the script. So in the Christian Testament, apparently the expression Ben Adam or son of man appears, and that kind of morphs into son of something else. So if I say I'm a person, a Ben Adam, which could have other allusions, the one commentary known as Korban Eidah says it means you're righteous and holy. But it could mean son of man. Go ahead.
Very righteous and holy. He will eventually be led astray. If he says, I will ascend to heaven, he can say it, but he cannot do it.
So some people feel that this is an illusion again in later generations. This is in the post-Rabbi Yochanan period. This is in the year 300 or so. And he's alluding to Christianity. So they're bumping into Christianity. Of course, The religion they're dealing with in Babylonian Talmud is not Christianity. What is it there in Babylonia? Zoroastrian religion, which is clearly a pagan or dualistic kind of system. Some people say it's not really dualistic, but it's generally assumed to be a dualistic, polytheistic system. And so you won't find as many allusions in the later generations of the Talmud, but in these earlier stories, some of which are found in the Talmud, reflecting earlier generations, they do refer to this. Okay. So if we talk about what is a Jewish relationship to Christianity in terms of our story that we tell about Christianity, the story is usually told in a very disparaging way, a way that was kind of embarrassing. We often had to take it out of the Talmud because it was just didn't look good. We're referring to him as somehow being licentious in this story. I don't know if that's connected with stories of, you know, the woman who grabbed Jesus' feet and he said it's okay or something. I don't know. But somehow he's not kosher. Witchcraft, fallen student, heretic. Okay. Then
I don't understand.
Yes.
I still don't get how that last paragraph we got in the words of Jesus, who says I'm a person.
Right.
Any person of
No, because we're not looking at the original. If he says he's a Ben Adam could be an expression that maybe.
Is that what it says in the Hebrew?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, right. Yeah, we'd have to look at it more carefully. Yes, I think that you'd be a little more convinced if we would talk
Jesus
more about.
Used the phrase Ben Adam.
Believe so. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was God.
The later biblical books, Ezekiel also uses Ben Adam, so it kind of sounded biblical, but it yes, but it. Yes.
So that during his lifetime, he
didn't
put himself out to be either the Messiah.
Right.
Whatever. He was just a teacher. And it was those who came, he was born to be down to Jew, but those who were born after him, namely his disciples, are the ones who set up the whole mindset.
Right. Yoel, you want to comment on that?
There's no consensus that he didn't see himself as the Messiah.
That he didn't?
He did see himself as the Messiah?
He did.
The majority of historians recognize that he didn't, and that he accepted himself as the Messiah. It's called self-understanding, which I don't think there's any major discussion about anymore in history among historians. Did he say he was God? That's a different discussion.
Apparently there's some ambiguity about that, but it starts with the word Ben Adam, which morphs into Son of God. So
no, Ben Adam.
Ben Adam is a person. Ben Adam is a simple word for person, but I believe what I recall from school is that it then morphs into Son of God.
That's
but Yoel, you want to comment on Jesus' self-perception as God?
It's a discussion. It comes out that like the way in the New Testament is a text, which is like in the first century, it's pretty clear that people ascribe some divine attributes to him, and also talks to him like he has the authority. In the New Testament, he talks like he has the authority of God.
When we talk about thank you, Yoel has a lot to say. Good to talk to him. Thank you. Now, just very briefly. Obviously, we're not getting into detail about it. But if we were talking about Jewish relationship to Christianity, I have to talk in general about, you know, what are some of the broad differences. And there are things that seem like differences and other things which are differences. Now, here when I'm referring to Christianity, I'm referring to it in its later form, okay? Not the original. We started with the discussion of early Christianity and some stories, Jewish stories about Jesus from the early period. Now I'm looking at just more broadly our relationship to Christianity. What are some ideas which clearly divide us? And what are some ideas which people think divide us but may not necessarily divide us? Yes?
Yeah. When was the New Testament supposedly written?
Most of it is afterwards, but we'll let you all make the full comment on it. Go ahead.
the letters of Paul are actually going to be 40 to 50 years after Jesus' ministry. And then the Gospels are either written in the year 60 or 70. And then the Apocalypse of John, which is the last book, the Testament is argued in the year 120. So between 30 and 100.
Right. Now, mind you, most rabbinic literature is written after all that.
Yes.
So that's why there may be confusion. They may say it's Rabbi Shulman Prachy, but it was a different rabbi. But it was a story, and this rabbi, it could be that rabbi. It was one of the rabbis. Anyway, so there's category A and category B. Areas where sometimes Christianity is portrayed as differing from Judaism, let's say original sin. Christianity believes in original sin. We don't believe in original sin. Well, there are rabbinic statements that everything goes back to the original sin, or that we're tainted by the original sin, or that we have other original sins, like the golden calf is our original sin, and that we're all tainted by that. So it's not necessarily a great difference. The afterlife is not a huge difference between Judaism and Christianity. The emphasis on original sin, the emphasis on afterlife is a difference, not beliefs per se. The idea of God as a God of love, a number of our scriptures from Hosea to Deuteronomy, other places say that God loves us. So that's, but again, the emphasis on God of love, or supposedly God of love, that's a difference. Vicarious suffering, the idea that he suffered for our sins. Well, they got it from Isaiah. It's right in there. So we believe that the Jewish people suffer for everybody else's sins. There can be vicarious atonement. The righteous suffer for everybody's sins. We differ again. That's at the centerpiece of their faith. And for us, it's a detail which you can find in certain passages. But again, another thing where Judaism and Christianity are often described as, or thought of as in conflict, but not necessarily as great a conflict as one thinks. Conflicts of body-soul, what's the emphasis? You could find in Hasidic literature, and mystical literature, the same emphasis on soul versus body, or more of a conflict. So sometimes that's portrayed as a difference. Asceticism, obviously in the monastic traditions and things, there's more asceticism. But there is a Jewish ascetic tradition as well. There were some Jewish ascetics as well, people who refrained from the things in this world. And recently my friend Mary Salvechik wrote an article about self-salvation, that they believe that only Jesus can redeem you, and we believe we can redeem ourselves. But that too could be dubious because we also believe that we need God to help redeem us. We pray every day for God to help us to do tshuva and everything else. So it's not necessarily a difference, although in broad strokes, that is the epicenter of their faith is you need Jesus to save you, otherwise you're doomed. And that goes back to original sin, goes back to Jesus suffering for our sins. You need him to atone. And we say that you do tshuva and you do mitzvos, and then with God's help, you can make it. So category A are things which people sometimes associate as a divergence or a difference between Judaism and Christianity, but it ain't necessarily so. But if we talk about differences that are clear, and I apologize if overly obvious, but just to get it out before we go on, in category B in differences on page 2 here, that the idea that God can have a form, God could take a form in a human being, and can you find a passage somewhere where maybe it seems to say that maybe God appeared in a maybe once or twice you could possibly find such a midrash or something like that, but generally my Maimonides for sure denied it, and we very clearly in Deuteronomy it says in Devarim that you did not see any image as God spoke to you at Sinai. So that's pretty clear to me. God has no form and cannot take a form. The idea that Messiah has arrived is clearly a big question. We obviously believe he did not. The Torah is fulfilled by Jesus. Here we have a huge conflict. Again, whether this was true in early Christianity or not, eventually it comes to the idea that you don't need to do any mitzvahs. Jesus fulfilled it all for you. Obviously, that's a huge digression. We're all about mitzvahs. They say Jesus did them for you. You don't have to do that stuff. So a big problem, the whole attitude toward the Old Testament and the harsh God of the Old Testament, the whole attitude towards the mitzvot, towards commandments, particularly in the Catholic tradition, clearly a great divergence between us and them. Obviously, any sort of replacement theology that the church is the new Israel or something like that, bad news. And obviously, a huge point of difference. Who is Israel? Okay. Now onto another topic, and that is, if indeed the Jews viewed Christianity as we did paganism, very simply, meaning we're not interested in whether they think that three is one, that the Trinity is one, that God and the Holy Ghost and Jesus is really one. We're not interested in the details of their theology. We just think it doesn't sound like monotheism to us. We have the same approach to paganism. We're not interested that they think that it's not this statue that it's their God. This is just a conduit to the ultimate God. We don't care. We view it as, you're bowing down to a statue and it can't speak and it can't hear. We like to infantilize the opponent. We like to infantilize the other view. So if that's the baseline assumption that Christianity, in as much as there's a Son of God, there's Jesus and God, they pray, many of them pray to Jesus, some of them have statues of Jesus, some of them bow down to it, some of them kiss the cross, some of them have images of Mary and other saints, and we view that as somewhat pagan, then how do we deal with all the restrictions in the particularly in the Talmud, where they say don't have that much to do with the pagans, keep arms distance from the pagans, these laws don't apply to pagans, pagans don't have these rights or these privileges, anything that applies to pagans, does it apply to Christians or not? If all the restrictions in the Talmud about pagans applied to Christians, we wouldn't be able to do business with them, because then they might come to court, and in court you would say, "Oh yeah, you don't owe me $1,000. Swear to it." And he's going to what? Swear on his polytheism? Swear to his gods? Swear to Jesus, who is not God? So you're going to cause it. So you can't do business with Gentiles. All their wine is, not only can you not drink it, but you can't even sell it. So when he comes to you and says, "Here, Jew, here's my payment of $10,000 to you. Here are ten barrels of wine," right? You'd have to say, "Could you pay me in credit, or could you pay me next Tuesday?" You would have to not accept money, not nem the geld, not take the money when they wanted to pay you back in barrels of wine. There would be tremendous restrictions. There are also, and you may find this surprising, but there are some statements in the Talmud that say that, well, basic morality applies. We have to conduct ourselves in a moral fashion toward all human beings. But anything beyond the basic, like restoring lost objects, right, or certain fines, that doesn't apply to pagans. It only applies to our people in our community. But for a pagan, you don't have to run after him to restore his lost object, to give him things that he lost, or things like that. So there are some very, very restrictive laws against pagans. Do they apply to Christians or not? So here, Jacob Katz did a lot of the work, and Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik and other people, to develop a history of how Jews dealt with this question of, are Christians pagan? And if they're not, then how do we explain that they believe in several deities, or and yet we can still not treat them like pagans? How can we actually do that? Good question.
Also, would Jews do in the realm, or were they?
Already in the Talmud, where they're pretty much, as we said before, in Babylonia, not dealing with Christians. Or even in Palestine, where it's pre-Christianity, it's pre-Constantine, it's pre-3rd, 4th century, and they're not dealing yet with a Christian environment, but it's a Roman pagan environment. They already had rules on the books that, A, we don't treat the pagans that well, but these people with us, who live with us, they're not really pagans. They already started to think along those lines, and we're going to use some of those leniencies, and then other leniencies we're going to pile on because they're Christians, which are somehow an elevated level beyond the pagans. So let's take a look. So firstly, the idea of keeping some distance from the Gentiles or the pagans, it is not just a Talmudic thing, but Daniel also says He didn't want to defile himself with the potbog of the king and from his banquet wine. Well, why isn't wine kosher? Why can't he have the wine from the pagans? It's just wine. It comes in grapes. It'd be kosher. Apparently, even in Daniel's days, there was an idea that we don't drink non-kosher wine, non-Jewish wine. And potbog, the bread, non-kosher bread. So Daniel ate seeds, he ate vegetables, he went a vegetarian diet. So you should know that certainly in the early Second Temple period, there are already Jews refraining from bread and wine of pagans. Now, so for instance, the Mishnah in Talmud Avodah Zarah says that these are the things that are prohibited, and their prohibition is that of drinking and benefit. You can't even sell this stuff to a Gentile. The wine and vinegar of an idol worshiper. So again, if the pagan owes me $1,000, pays me back with a barrel of wine, I have to throw that barrel of wine in the garbage. I can't sell that barrel of wine to another Gentile and get my money back. That's what it seems to say.
But I have to take it and lose money from it?
Well, that's the question. Maybe that would be a leniency. You say, wait, but it's loss of money. So maybe because of loss of money, maybe somehow that would make it different. But it seems that was the law. That itself was the law. The law was that despite the loss of money, you can't have it. It's pagan money. Okay.
But only with these particular objects that are used in their worship.
Right, so there are two reasons for not using their wine. One is that they may maybe with this wine itself, part of this wine or wine is attached to this, or while it was in the vat, maybe they libated part of this wine to their gods. So that's one problem. And the second problem is that we want to refrain from overly being fraternizing too much with them, because perhaps our daughters will come to marry their sons or vice versa. So there are two reasons for it. So the Rambam, for instance, says a ger toshav, a resident alien who accepts it on himself the seven laws, his wine is still forbidden to drink, and is permitted to benefit from. He could still benefit from his wine because he's not an idolater, and so any idol worshiper who does not worship idols like these Yishmaelim, these Arabs, their wine is forbidden to drink, but it's permitted to benefit from. So Maimonides says, I'm living with the Muslims, doesn't apply to them. They're not pagans. You can sell the bottle. You can't drink it because you won't marry their daughters. But it's not considered so forbidden that it's idolatrous, such that you can't benefit from it. With the Ishmaelim, which we'll talk about next week, you could use their wine. But implication, but with the Christians, their wine would be forbidden. You couldn't even benefit from it. Now there is a source which the commentary on the Rambam mentions that in the Talmud one of the rabbis says that he did once send a gift to someone on his pagan holiday, and he says, he's not a pagan, I know he doesn't worship idols. So here's one excuse when dealing with pagans. You say, they're not really into it. They don't really believe in that stuff. In other words, when they give a gift to their priest, it's not a religious thing. It's just sort of a social thing. So that's a leniency.
So like people say that Christmas things.
Right. Hagot Maimonides of Rabbi Rothenberg in the 13th century, he says on the bottom of the page here, they're not devoted to it. That the Akum today, the Gentiles today, they're not experts in the nature of idolatry. They're not devoted to it. They're like a child taken captive. They don't really know what they're doing. They're not really into it. This is one type of excuse that people use in dealing with Christians, that they're not really pagans because they don't really know what they're doing. They're not really into it. So that's one technical type of way of looking at it.
Rabbi, does Christianity in general endorse the seven laws?
Right, so all right, the seven law, right? They don't eat live animals, right? They don't kill anybody, they live a moral life, they don't steal, right? But, right, Right, but they might worship idols. That's the question. One of the things is they can't.
According to the Rambam,
right, the Rambam is director. We're going to get. We'll get to it. Right, right. Right, well, he lived in jail. Ray Rothenberg lived in jail. You want to know what's going on? Ray Rothenberg is living. Yeah, well, okay. You're already getting to apologize. We haven't finished learning. Then, no, I mean, you're already trying to explain the kind of, but we haven't. Right, let's do that. Right, let's do that. Okay, so. Right, so right, so if you're uncomfortable with this comparison to pagan, let's go through the sources. Let's go through the sources. The rabbis were also uncomfortable with it. Let's go through the sources, and then let's hear what you have to say, Lenny. I want to hear what you say, but only after we see the Meiri and the Re. So let's see. Let's just turn. We're going to go backwards for a second. We're going to turn to the next page. And the pages are not numbered. We're going to turn to the page that says that on the top says. You already know. You got that page? You already know. So one of the rules that apply to pagans is that you can't do business on their holidays. Right? Now, as a Jewish merchant, what's the problem with not doing business on their holidays?
Sunday is a holiday.
Good. Sunday. Well, they don't usually have stores open on Sunday, but right, can you sell them something so they can do their worship on Sunday? And what's the bigger holiday that where there's a lot of business attached to it? Christmas. So if a Jew can't do business to get the Christian ready for Christmas, we're in big trouble. So on that page there, that where the first words are, you already know. So there are again technical answers, like the one time. It says Rabbi Judah, the heretic sent Rabbi Judah, prince, a dinar to the Kaiser on his holiday. And Reish Lakish was there and he said, what should we do? If he takes it, he will go, don't take it, it will cause hatred. You have to accept the gift from the pagan on his holiday, because if not, it will cause hatred. So here's another technical answer. He says, well, even if Christians are pagan, if they give me a gift on their holiday, take it. If not, it will cause hatred. Or maybe if we close our stores down before Christmas, maybe that would cause hatred. Things like that. Then there's another excuse to use in the bold letters here in the paragraph that begins Tosfot. That's the Rashi's grandchildren. Here we deal with the question of, if I do business with a Gentile, and then we get into a dispute and we go to court, I'm forcing him to swear on his Bible, and he's going to swear in the name of Jesus. What do we do? So there's an idea mentioned here in the bold. It's like saving it from their hands. That sometimes when the pagan gives you something, you can accept it because you got to save it from their hands. It's sort of like, well, it's a monetary problem. We've got to save it from their hands. So Tosfot used this logic saying that maybe sometimes we could collect a loan. Let's say a Gentile says, oh, Merry Christmas. I'm so happy to see you, Mr. Goldberg. I know I've been very bad about paying back my loans all year. But it's going to make me so happy. I'll have a wonderful Christmas if you just please accept, you know, half of my payment today, and I'll give it to you. According to the Talmud, you can't accept it. He's going to go and thank God that he paid off his loans, and it's a problem. So he says, no, you've got to save that money from his hands. He's ready to give you money. Take it. You right? So that's the rabbinic solution there, and you can take it. Then, what about swearing? So go there, see the next bold area there. Even though, right? Even though they mention heaven's name and their intent is for something else. Even when a Christian says God, he means Jesus. Now let me explain something about the way some Christians think. I can't speak for all Christians, not an expert. Sometimes we get very upset. We go to ecumenical dinners and some preachers will get up and say, and the prayer I just said, which is so beautiful and ecumenical, I'm saying it in Jesus' name. Yeah. Why do they do that? Because they believe that there's no prayer through, you can't make a prayer through God. That's the Father. That's, you make only through, there's only salvation, only prayer, you can only approach God through Jesus. So even if you can get the pagan to be ecumenical or the Christian to be ecumenical, and he'll say, I swear in God's name, His intent is for something else. He's thinking about Jesus. Still, it's not the name of an idol. In other words, let's say he swears by Mary. It's not really an idol. She's not an idol. And they also intend to the maker of heaven and earth. Don't forget, Christians believe in God, so they're also thinking about the heaven and earth. So here, Lenny, we're getting a little closer to a more modern view that a Christian is not thinking about paganism. He's thinking of the maker in heaven and earth, too. Even though they join the name of heaven and something else, they'll say in the name of God and Jesus or the Trinity or something like that, we do not find that it's forbidden to cause others to combine God and another God. In other words, if he swears in the name of Zeus, so that's a problem. But if he swears in the name of Zeus and God, we don't know that that's a prohibition or that there's a prohibition for me to cause him to say that. And it's also not putting a stumbling block, since the sons of Noah were not... I'm causing him to swear in the name of another God? No, I'm only causing the Christian to swear in the name of God plus Jesus. And for a Gentile, that's okay. So here is a more open theology, it seems, that says Christian thinking about God and Jesus, for a Christian, for the Goyim, is good enough. That's what it sounds like. That's what it sounds like, in which case this is a major concession to Christianity, that at least for Christians, it's not so trafe. For a Jew, that's a pure monotheism. For him, not. However, there was a note to the Rabbi Cheskel Landau says, wait a second, is that what Tosfot meant? Tosfot, Rashi's grandchildren, is that what they meant? He says, no, he doesn't think so. Now, one might think so, but Rabbi Landau didn't think so. Whether the Landaus in Memphis are related to this rabbi is a matter of dispute, but it could be. He says, he does not mean that a Gentile can believe in two gods. It's not that light paganism is permitted for Goyim. No, rather that in the oath, he doesn't declare them gods. He just swears by them, which is prohibited for us, but not for them. Notice we have a separate prohibition. Only swear by God. Can't swear by something else. They're swearing by God and also something else. That's not one of the seven laws of Noah. They can make whatever oaths they want. That's no big deal. But as to whether they can have this type of theology personally, no, we're not giving them license to believe in God plus. We're just talking about these technical laws of oaths. You're causing him to swear an oath in the name of God plus. So there are two readings of Tosfot. One is that Tosfot opens this whole new theological door to Christians. He says, Gentiles don't have to be pure monotheists. They can believe in God plus, and somehow that's not paganism. Or that, no, he's just saying something technical about oath making. And for Gentiles, this oath in which Jesus is thrown into the mix is not a big problem because it's just about oath making. So this is one of two views. So we've had, let's just review and we'll take questions and we'll go on to the next point. We've had, so how can you deal with, if the rabbis were so restrictive in laws against pagans, so much so, you can't accept a bottle of wine from them and you can't sell it. You can't do business with them before Christmas and Easter, which is a major business time. And you can't do business with them because you're going to cause them to do oaths. How do we deal with all these problems? So they found in the Talmud where they already had various leniencies for pagans. That maybe they're not such devoted pagans anymore. Pagans ain't what they used to be. If you name the gelt, and if they're trying to give you money, you got to save the money when you can. You don't want to cause hatred. Sorry? Right. These are all sort of technical minor answers, assuming that Christians are pagans. I understand why a lot of us would feel uncomfortable. What? Christians are pagans? But this assumes that, yes, they are pagans. Comes to Tosfot and maybe opens a new door that says, no, they're not really pagans. For them, that's not paganism because they're just, the Gentiles are not prohibited to merge God with someone else. As long as they know about heaven, the God of heaven and earth, then they're in good shape. Based on this, maybe Hindus, which we're not going to talk about, maybe they also believe in an ultra God. So they're the big God. So on this basis, I don't know who's a pagan. I'm not sure who would be a pagan because most pagans have an ultimate deity. Even Zeus, is a big one. But so far we had technical answers and we had this answer which might open a new theology for Gentiles. Any questions at this point, and then we'll go on to the Meiri. Yes?
Are the rabbis not, as time is evolving, making it easier or finding ways for us to at least do business with or live in a society with the people around us as we have to?
So the question is, are the rabbis doing this simply because it's an exigency, it's something we've got to get done, we've got to do business, or is this are they fundamentally believe in this stuff? And so firstly, as we see, that there's two different types of leniency. Some of them continue to believe what we believe, that it's polytheism, and others are getting deeper into a fundamental restatement of what Christianity is. But as to why they would make any of these statements or any of these concessions, is it simply that, you know, when there's rabbinic pressure, that they themselves feel pressured, their people are asking them questions, they themselves have to come up for their own business purposes, they have to come up with solutions to these very difficult problems? Are they just under pressure to do this? And really, these answers are not good answers. These Talmudic excuses are not really good excuses. And they're just sort of throwing out these, they're trying to latch on to whatever leniency they can come up with. Or is this like good, tight Talmudic work? So Jacob Katz portrays it as like, well, it's the rabbis, they're under pressure, and nothing, you know, so over the years they became more and more lenient, and until, you know, one day the great revelation will come and we'll be really lenient. That's one way of viewing the history of rabbinic leniencies. Another way of viewing it is that if you look at some of these sources inside, we don't have time to like work through every single line here. As you see, we're going through some of these passages kind of cursorily. If you go through some of these, they say, well, you could be lenient about that, but in fact, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, wasn't lenient about it. So you see some of them like struggling with it more, actually coming to a conclusion that, no, you can't always say yes to every question. So I don't always see them buckling under the pressure. But there are different views as to how you view rabbinic leniencies. Is it always just giving into pressure, or is it more real scholarship? Yes.
In history, it's something. Philosophy of history is something called genetic fallacy. It's just because the cause of something that comes from. Doesn't mean that the logic that or the event then is invalid, meaning that just because the rabbis needed to have a way to do business with Christians, that itself does not mean that the answers they came up with are not valid answers.
That's good. That's good.
So
that's
even
good.
If they're under pressure, it doesn't invalidate the answers. And if you look at the answers, they're fairly good because most people are, if you look at Christian religious, they constantly complain that people are not devoted to their religion, which is exactly what the rabbis are saying. They're not devoted to their religion, so they're not real Christians. Or, also, when Moshe received the Torah, right, they were real idol worshippers, but now you have this hybrid thing. So, mm-hmm. A community tries to speculate, is this real or not? That is not necessarily an excuse. That's a Jewish question. Mm-hmm. Is this a Jewish thing? Is this a semi-Jewish thing?
Right. Well, I think there's a lot, and fear of hate. Fear of hatred.
I see what y'all are saying. On the other hand, we can say, well, if the rabbis were allowed to be this lenient, then what in theory is wrong with non-Orthodox Judaism? Because they'll say the same thing. Well, our followers have to make a living too. We have to keep up with the modern world.
Right, so that's where we're talking about a tight scholarship, meaning, and it's a judgment call where it's tight and where it's not tight. Everyone always claims that they're doing good scholarship. As one might say that a halachic Jew is someone who brings a source for everything he does. Now, then there's a question of what's the methodology of it? How do you find what's considered a legitimate source? What's considered a legitimate rabbinic work or halachic work? What Chaim Soloveitchik taught me is that when you see the rabbis doing heavy-duty lifting and finding many passages in the Talmud and struggling with some of the passages, whether these leniencies are kosher, they're not kosher, then you feel like they're doing real work. I think what you will find is that some of the later rabbis, in Rashi's school, Rashi's grandchildren, the Tosfot, began to discover that some of the leniencies that were given by the early German rabbis, who were not as complex in their scholarship, were insufficient. That the early rabbi just said, oh, they don't really believe in their religion, so forget about it. So then all these laws don't apply. And the later rabbis worked harder to get more tight answers. Oh, in this case, we're going to use this leniency. That case, we'll use this leniency. And so sometimes you see real scholarship at work. Now we can go back to the previous page. I know it's a little dizzying which side we're on, but we go back to the previous page, the other side of that page. First word on the page is grandson, parentheses. The first word on the page is grandson. If you're on the page with grandson, you're in good shape. Ready? Everybody good? Okay. Now we turn to the Meiri. So the Meiri lived in Provence, and the Meiri is the people find this Meiri just fascinating, and there's a big debate right now in the Orthodox community as to whether to accept the Meiri's ruling. Meiri is fascinating from so many different points of view. Firstly, he wrote a sweeping commentary on the Talmud in a crisp Hebrew that's so beautiful. He just explains everything in the Talmud and all the different commentaries, and it's a great job. Another interesting thing about him, unfortunate fact, is that his writings were mostly lost for centuries and only rediscovered in the 1920s and 30s. So he was sort of out of it. He wasn't in the mainstream of halachic decisors, except for a few things that they remembered here and there. Shita Mekubetzet, other books, collections of what he said. So he's sort of a latecomer, even though he's from the 13th, 14th century, from Provence. He's from the community that died in Provence, the community of a unique community in southern France. They had their own country, and it was its own region, and it had their own Jewish community. And in 1400s, the community was expelled, and he was one of the great luminaries earlier on. And he has this new insight and the new approach to Christianity. And whether that becomes the way we view Christianity is now a debate between the right-wing and left-wing Orthodoxy today, in 2014. It is 14, right? The Meiri. Okay, so here's the problem. You're supposed to return lost objects of your brother that are lost to him, of your brother, Achicha, Avidat Achicha. So the rabbi said, lost object, that's not... If you lose something, and I, by the way, I found a tie clip. Anybody lost a tie clip? Let me know. To return your tie clip, it's a pain in the neck. I don't have time to look for people's tie clips. But for my brothers, I'll try to make some time. But for people who are not in my community, I don't have to make time. If American law dictates it, I'll follow American law. But if it doesn't, I don't have time to go running around finding people's tie clips. But what about Christians? Maybe they are your brothers. So as the Talmud says, doesn't apply to pagans. Comes the Meiri and he says, "There's no brotherhood for worshippers of idols, of false gods. They're not brothers. Who are not under the fence of religions, with nations who are fenced in the ways of religion." It's a long. She'inan tarad im haumot toderadat. It's a little unclear, but I believe the way it's usually understood to mean is that they're not brothers because they're not fenced in the ways of religion. But if you know anybody who's fenced in the way of religion, no, his life is guided by, it's fenced in, it's contained within the ways of religion, of dat, then you would restore his lost object.
So
no
if he's a religious man,
right.
No matter what the religion
right.
is.
Right, right. It has to be a religion that promotes, you know, morality and goodness and stuff like that, even though he's well aware of, you know, the Crusades and other problems, you know, that you know, at times there were Christian outbursts or what, but, and 100 years later they'll be expelled from Provence, but people who have the ways of religion's people, they're in good shape. Another example, right? If I damage a Gentile, so I have to pay for it. What if my donkey or my ox gores a Gentile. Well, again, you could say that it's not your brother's ox. So somehow, and this is very surprising, and again, I'm not going to sit here and engage in any apologetics of that. I don't know. It's a strange thing that the rabbis didn't make it apply to pagans. Comes the Meiri again, and he says, but if they keep the seven laws, then they are like our laws, and we do not give special treatment to ourselves. In other words, you can't, what are we going to say? We're only going to deal with, right? We have to give them, what do you mean? Well, we're going to only treat ourselves? If my ox gores you, then I have to pay for it, but if it gores the Gentile, I don't have to pay for it when he's keeping the seven laws of Noah? And therefore it is obvious that this is so with the nations who are fenced in with the ways of religion and manners. Although the Talmud excludes these laws for pagans, and don't think Christians didn't notice this in public disputations with Christians. They often brought this up. They said, your Talmud is disgusting. It says that if your ox gores my ox, then you don't have to pay because we're pagans, or and you treat us that way. So he comes and says, no, this doesn't apply to Christians. He doesn't use the word Christian, but that's, he lives in the Christian, southern France, is also Catholic.
No, but he's saying no idols.
Yeah, but he had to add, right, because we know that we could say that Christians don't keep Noahide laws, so he comes back and he says, Noahide laws, plus, lest you think that Christians don't qualify because of the paganism factor, if they're fenced in with the ways of religion. Now, where did he get this category from? What is this? And then, is this apologetics? Is he saying this because you know, the Christians are they're looking in our Talmud, there are a lot of apostates, a lot of Jews become Christians. It's a lot easier to be Christian in Europe than to be Jewish. Many apostates become, they study Talmud, they're Jews, they become Christians, they become enemies of the Jews, they point to passages in the Talmud that are unequal, unfair, and maybe he's trying to defend them. But there's, what about this does not make it seem like apologetics? Second to last line. Second and third to last line. Yeah, but maybe he's making up this category just to make the Christians happy, and then they won't complain that our laws are no good.
Yeah. I think it's more humanitarian.
Because of what? He does say, yes. Can you pick a word? Can you pick a word?
We do not give special treatment to ourselves,
yes.
And therefore it is obvious.
Yes, right. Kol Shekinah is certainly, he doesn't say obvious, certainly it's so with the nation. So certainly, it sounds like he's pretty serious. And also, he seems indignant. What are you going to give special treatment to ourselves? Only when we gore our oxen, then we can pay for it. If we gore Christians' oxen, you're not going to do it. If they're idolaters, pagan, you know, but we don't. We are in a war against paganism. I mean, you know, so but so why would I want to give them any money? But if they keep the seven laws and they're fenced in, why should we give special treatment to ourselves? Special treatment? He didn't have to say that. He could just say, oh, it applies to Christians. But to say that we don't want to lama ein nosim panim badin, we can't have unfairness in the court. Sounds like he's serious. But people, this comment did make it into the Code of Jewish Law, even though the Meiri was not widely quoted. They found this comment, they pasted it into the Ber Hagola somewhere, a footnote in the Code of Jewish Law, and that pasting might be cynical. Now the guy who pasted it in the Code of Jewish Law. In the 1700s, that might be cynical, but his reading does not seem cynical. Yes, Steve?
In the Hebrew, what is fence? Where do you see fence?
Gedurot. Gader. Gedurot. Gedurot. Right before that. Hagedurot. Gader is a, yeah, gader is a fence. Gedurot. Gedurot are those who are fenced in as a verb. Then there's something about gift giving. And again, you may find this, you know, I'm sorry that I'm in the context of this, I'm just throwing at you all these different things about the Talmud that may seem strange to you, and we can certainly talk about it in some other context or afterwards or what, if you're bothered by these things, and surely these are questions. They're not just for the rabbis in ancient times, as was mentioned. We should all wonder, is this fair? What? Again, I don't think we should feel bad about a war against paganism. I think generally we've been part of a Western war on paganism ever since the Crusaders, the conquest of America. But still, if you're bothered, we can certainly talk about it. But in any event, gift giving. So the rabbis interpreted a verse in Deuteronomy that may be referring to the seven nations who lived in Canaan, who we were wiping out at the time. But I said, don't be nice to them. The rabbis interpreted, don't give them gifts for nothing. Don't just like, hey, nice to see you. I'm just going to give you this gift out of the goodness of my heart. Now, rarely does a human being give a gift purely out of the goodness of their heart, because if you give a gift to your neighbor, you want them to be a good neighbor. If you give a gift to your people you work with, you want them to be good people you work with. If you give a gift to your worker, it's a payment. So it's rare that you give a purely altruistic gift, but you should not. But according to Talmudic law, you can't give a purely altruistic gift to a pagan. So does this apply to Christians? So he says, but it says the page that begins you already know. The page that is the first word is the other side of grandson. You already know. You got it? You already know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, my page function doesn't work on my computer. You already know. All right, we're trying to keep the pagans away from ourselves. But the Tosefta says that's only a Gentile that you don't know, or he's passing through, but your neighbor or friend, you can give it to him anyway. I scratch your back, you scratch my back. It's not really an altruistic gift. But if he's from the nations who are fenced in with the ways of religion, who admit a God, here's something new, and who admit a God. Didn't say that before. Before, he almost seemed to be saying that what? As long as he what?
Moral.
Moral. Now he's saying not only is he moral, but also he has some kind of God. That sounds a little more like who said that before? The Tosfot said before, the Rashi's grandchildren said that, well, they think about God too. They're just adding another God. But so he's saying that they admit a God. There's no doubt that even if you don't know them, it's permitted and fitting. And it already says you may send a side of beef to a Gentile. There's a story in Talmud and Chulin. You can give it to him. So, and that was even before Christianity. Wishful thinking. I don't see that, but it could be. Certainly, there is a right. There, and again, in every gift, there's always an ulterior motive. So, mm-hmm. If the Gentiles think well of the Jews, it doesn't hurt in terms of moving toward that direction.
Don't you think sometimes you can give something just out of love?
It's an interesting discussion, but not for now. Moving along. Right? That's an interesting philosophical question. Is there such a thing as altruism? Okay, moving along. Now, so we talked about Jewish attitudes toward the early Christian story. We said that there are traditions that maybe he was some kind of rabbi or student of a rabbi, maybe some kind of witchcraft. Then there's another interesting question, and that is, and I alluded to it at the beginning, do we think that he had, what is his role in Jewish, does Jesus have any significance for us? I think Christians sometimes ask us that question. What does he mean to you? My old answer before really thinking about it was nothing, right? Absolutely nothing. We were Jews before he was born. There were Jews after he was born. I didn't become Jewish because I rejected Jesus. I never rejected Jesus. I have nothing to do with Jesus. I never did, never will. And that was my answer before. However, we already saw before that someone viewed that in that manuscript, they viewed Jesus as a person who was engaged, a heretic. So is he a fallen rabbi? Rabbi Salvation once claimed, and he was very old at the time, we couldn't find the passage, that there's a lamentation somewhere that says, oi, he was a rabbi, and then he went away, and what a shame, you know, he left Judaism. It was like the Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur or something. Somebody wrote a poem like lamenting his descendancy into paganism, or into who knows what. But we did say that one passage says he was involved in witchcraft. There's another story of a man who was very sick and he was cured by one of these miraculous sort of Jesus students or something. And then the rabbi said, yeah, he saved your life, but it's better you shouldn't have taken the witchcraft from him because he's no good. There's a lot of stories about him being some sort of witch. So that's a different idea. That means there was a Jesus. He did miracles, and we just think it was witchcraft and using God's name, the use of magical, mystical use of God's name to perform miracles. Now, there are other passages that speak in those terms. If you look at the Rambam, which also the censors took out this passage, this is the most famous passage about this. There's something about it that's very surprising. Let's see. So in order to be Mashiach, you have to restore the Torah to the Jews and restore the Jews to Israel and build the temple. And you got to do a lot of things, which clearly Jesus never did. But in any event, by the way, just notice that for Christians, shortly after Jesus lived, there was no temple. And for Jews, a Messiah is someone who rebuilds the temple, right? But they would say, oh, you lost your temple because you didn't accept Jesus. But if we're like, yeah, but you're not Mashiach if you didn't build the temple. So it's very interesting. Moving along, the page that begins with God, not your grandparents, but God. The first word on the page is God. That's the Rambam in the very end of his book, at the end of his Mishneh Torah, and the Book of Law, and it's the Book of Kings. And he says, Jesus of Nazareth. Who would like to read that? It's only found in the more recent editions. The older editions don't talk about this because we don't want to talk about Jesus in Christian books. In books printed in the Christian world, we don't talk about Jesus. But in the original edition of the Rambam says the following. Who would like to read that? Mindy?
Jesus of Nazareth, who was fired to be the Mashiach and was executed by the court, was also alluded to in Daniel's prophecy.
But now it's not clear which court in Jewish tradition. We may have done it. Shh, don't tell anybody. Right? In Jewish tradition, there are, but it doesn't make sense. The Erev Pesach, you can't execute people on Erev Pesach. The Jews, the Sanhedrin wasn't executing people anymore. But by the year, what year did he supposedly die? 40. Right? We weren't executing people right before the temple was destroyed. But anyway, go ahead.
Alluded to Daniel's prophecies, states the vulgar among your people shall be welcome to the principle of the vision, but they shall stumble.
So, listen to that. He believes that there's a verse in Daniel that refers to Jesus. We spend all of our time, every time a missionary comes and says, see, this verse in the Bible is talking about Jesus. Ah, it's not talking about Jesus. Nothing in the Bible is talking about Jesus. Jesus didn't even live 500 years later. Comes the Rambam and he says, there's a verse in Daniel. You know what it's talking about? Jesus. It's talking about Jesus. It's saying that that there's this vulgar, the person who's going to be Jewish from among your people, and he's going to exalt himself and say he's God or something, and attempt to fulfill a vision, and they shall stumble, become Christian or what?
But it's a plural.
Well, I don't know. We'd have to look at the original.
I'm not sure.
It might be a singular. Sorry?
The Rambam might be talking about a category of person.
Okay. Okay. It could be, but he was alluded to. It sounds pretty good, but it's possible. Go ahead. Look at the next line. Look at the next line. Go ahead.
Can there be a greater stumbling block in Christianity?
In other words, what do you mean they'll stumble? I think this is the best interpretation of this verse because Christianity really made the Jews stumble. Go ahead.
All the prophets spoke of Mashiach as their redeemer of Israel, and the faithful who were who gathered the dispersed and strengthened their rivers of the mitzvah. In contrast, Christianity called the Jews to be slain by the sword, the remnants to be scattered and humbled, the poor to be altered, and the majority of the world to err and serve God rather than the Lord.
So that's the sort of negative aspect of the Rambam's writings about Christianity, and he does think it's technically paganism in terms of the laws we talked about before.
Is
but
this a direct quote from the Rambam?
This is direct. But Nevertheless, Steve, take it away. Nevertheless. Who would like to read?
Okay. Nevertheless, the intended disposal of the world is not within the power of man to comprehend. His will is not ours, nor his thoughts are ours. Ultimately, all the deeds of Jesus of Nazareth and the Ishmaelite who were brought to him only serve to prepare the way for Mashiach's coming and the improvement of the entire world, motivating the nations to serve God together, surrounding the states, and to transform the peoples to receive their language that they will all call upon the name of God and serve him with one purpose.
So now look what's happening. Now all of a sudden, the advent of Christianity is also bolstering the prophecy of Tzfanya. So here it's not like there's a special verse in Tzfanya that's referring to Jesus, but Christianity is bringing the world close. It's still paganism, in his view, in terms of the technical laws of doing business, but he doesn't have to worry about it because he doesn't live with Christians. But in terms of the vision of the Jews for the world to transform and where everyone recognizes God, we're moving closer thanks to the Christians. The Netziv on the bottom of the page also says that to join it will know and understand that Abraham's faith in the Supreme God. There's some positive statements there by Rabbi Hirsch. In the 19th century, both Netziv and Rabbi Hirsch make some positive statements about Christianity. Who can find that for us? In this way, people will know Abraham merited to faith. And let's see, what does he say? He says. Yes, Netziv. Even those who will not join your faith to worship the one unique God, which will be unlike the other various religions which despise and belittle the faith, but this will not be the way of Abraham, for even those who do not wish to join it will know and understand that Abraham's faith in God, in the Supreme God, is great. So he's saying that everybody knows that Abraham, even Christians know that Abraham was great. So that's one statement of Samson Shafal Hirsch. Also, he says that how much more so with the fourth line, non-Jews who serve the God of the Bible, creator of heaven and earth, who keep the cardinal commandments, the main commandments. Right? The Talmud puts them in regard to duty between man and man on exactly the same level as Jews. Sounds like the Meiri. Right? So, he's living in Germany there. And then you have this strange fellow, Leon de Medina, which I think Baron Hirsch, they read a book about him, or his autobiography. He also says that, you know, the Trinity is not as bad as you think it is. There are a lot of Kabbalists who also talk about God in different parts of God. It's a very radical thing to say, but it's interesting to note. Okay. So the significance of Jesus for Jews. So we have the Rambam Maimonides saying that it's a fulfillment of the verse in Daniel. Then you have the rabbi saying that he did witchcraft, meaning that we agree that he did miracles. Okay. You have a special fast day on the 9th of Tevet in a 16th century list of fasts for the birthday of Jesus, or maybe it was Paul or Peter. And Shulchan Aruch says that we don't know what it is, but it's a fast day. So there's a special fast day for the day he was born, almost like what I heard from my salvagic that we're sad that this Jew, you know, turned in the wrong direction. Then you have this weird literature in the Middle Ages. It starts in the Talmud. We noticed the Talmud kind of, it's like having childish fun with him. You know what I mean? They want to like call him that he was a son of a harlot, and you know, and he's licentious. He's making comments about the girls and stuff. You know, and then Toldot Yeshu takes that like square. Toldot Yeshu, an early medieval work about the true Jewish history of Jesus. And it says all kinds of stuff like he lifted his arms like the wings of an eagle and he flew between heaven and earth, and I don't know, there's all kinds of weird stuff there, but he used the second to last line, he defiled the letters of the ineffable name, he used a special witchcraft using the ineffable name of God, and he escaped them. Because of this deed of Judah, they weep on the eve of the birth of Yeshu. We continue to weep on the day of his birth. So there's this whole medieval lore about weird mystical things that he did. And therefore, we don't study on the night of Christmas lest we merit to accrue his soul, which is in hell. In other words, as Jews, we're sitting around thinking about the soul of Jesus. He has to stay where he is. We don't want to give him on his yurt site. We don't want to learn any Torah. He might get some of the credit. And he's, I mean, like, say from other. Okay. This is not Rabbi Hirsch is in our community. Rabbi Tziv is in our community. This is coming from like a Hasidic kind of a community where people are saying no Torah study allowed, and many non-Hasidic religious Jews also did this until the war. It was very common in Europe, people not to study Torah on Christmas night for all kinds of reasons, and one of the reasons was that the spirit of Jesus is around. Watch out, the spirit is going around, and you watch out. As if we believe that he was born on Christmas.
Yeah.
As if we believe he was born on Christmas, which is probably nonsense. Right? Maybe he was born on the 9th of Tevet. It's another idea. He was born on the 9th of Tevet. So I'm bringing this not because, Lenny, that I endorse this sort of thinking. I'm bringing this because there's a history of Jews thinking of him as a someone they have a relationship with, a very, very negative relationship with, but someone who did actual miracles. Not, again, not the image I was brought up with, which was, I don't believe any of that stuff, he didn't do any of that stuff, he's nothing, it means nothing to me, I have nothing to do with him, and I'm the same as a Jew who lived before he was born and after he was born, nothing to do with him. The Rambam's thinking, he is a fulfillment of a test of the Jews passed the test of Christianity. We didn't all become Christians. According to the Talmud, he did perform some of these miracles, but we just think it was witchcraft. His spirit is still around. And finally, we'll conclude with one thing, and then we can open to more discussion. Prayer. In prayer, what do we have to say about Christians? You know, are we saying anything about Christians in our prayer? We allude to them or anything? Well, Rabbi Gamliel lived after the destruction of the temple. So Jesus is dead. Early Christianity is around. It's not that powerful or anything. Jews and Christians are fighting tooth and nail. And he institutes a 19th blessing, or 18th, 19th blessing. Certain fellow, Shimon Kapuli, says this blessing. What it said in that blessing, we don't know, but it's called the Birkat HaMinim. It's called the blessing of the heretics. Said before, mean, heretic, sometimes applies to Christians. The fellow who taught Jesus' teaching in the earlier passage was called a mean heretic. So here's one. So I have several versions here of the blessing, which is found in our prayer book today. And this goes to the last page and the second to last page of your booklet. So it says, "For the apostates, let there be no hope. And the arrogant government be speedily uprooted in our days." Who's that? Who's the arrogant government?
Rome.
"Let the Notzrim and the Minim be destroyed in a moment." And the blessing is called the blessing of the Minim. The only thing is, in some editions, it doesn't mention the Notzrim or the Minim. And the final words of the blessing are not Shover Minim or Machnia Minim. The final words of the blessing are Shover Oyvim, the God breaks the enemies, and Machnia Zedim, and he humbles the arrogant. So, whether the original text had the word Notzrim, which some say is a later word meaning Christian, or not, we don't know. The word Minim, in the Talmud, this blessing is referred to as the blessing of the Minim, meaning it's a prayer against the Minim, and Minim sometimes refers to Christians. It could refer to the Gnostics. It could refer to the Essenes. It could refer to any other. There were almost all these different sects that developed at that time. So maybe it refers to them. Let's see. You have here in the early Sidurim from the 9th century, 10th century, or of Amram Gaon. Some of the editions, it says Notzrim Minim. So is it is Christianity, when we ask what is our relationship with Christianity, do we care? Do we how often do we think about it? According to some, there's a daily blessing against the Christian. Now, most probably, this is not designed to be a blessing against Christians today. It's designed to be against heretics. What's a heretic? What did we say before? A heretic has to be Jewish. So it's against early Christians who were both Jewish and Christian. I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik an interesting thing. There's a Talmudic passage that says that if a Gentile keeps the Sabbath, we should kill him. Gentile learns Torah, we should kill him. So you say, well, why is that? And does that apply today? If a Gentile walked in the class here, I would throw him out because I'm not allowed to teach Torah to Gentiles? So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, and behind closed doors, he said, well, that's probably in early Christianity. It was early Christians, and they were parading as Jews. They would sometimes get up to be the chazan. When they got to this blessing, they would say, they would start mumbling, and then they would give them the hook and say, if you can't say that blessing more clearly, you're out. You had to say this blessing. That was a test. It became a litmus test for Christians hiding in the Jewish community. And similarly, you wouldn't want to teach them Torah because you're trying to get the Christians out of the community. You don't want to teach the Gentiles. The early Christians, early Gentiles were trying to become Jewish. You don't want to teach them Torah. You don't want them observing Sabbath because they'll become indistinguishable from the Jews. There was a whole effort to uproot the early Christians. And we fought tooth and nail. And there were massacres on both sides. So our blessing today does not mention the word heretic. Most Jews, I think there are some Sephardic Jews who have the word heretic in there. Nobody has Notzrim, which usually means Christian. But not surprisingly, the Muslim Jews who lived in Muslim countries, the Sephardic Jews, would preserve a more pure blessing because they were less worried about what the Christians would say. But today, the blessing, I associate it with enemies in general. I don't think so much about the Jewish enemies. I don't think it has that meaning so much anymore. But in the middle of our Shemoneh Esrei, there is sort of a, originally, there was a blessing against the early Christians. Yes?
In the alignment, there's a part that sometimes in there, sometimes over. I guess it referred to Christianity, but it says they pray
it. Could vanity, right. And emptiness. Right. Vanity and emptiness in acrostic does spell Yeshu. So some people wanted to say that, Hevel Vari. Some people say that it is an allusion to, there is an allusion there to Jesus. So in any event, we laid out our relationship to Christianity. Number one, we do have a Jewish story of Jesus. I'm not saying it's the most historic one, neither is the Christian one. The actual story of Jesus is kind of murky, but we do have a Jewish version. Whether, again, it was written later than the actual events, but interesting to note. We talked about some dubious differences between Judaism and Christianity, and some real differences. We talked about the three stages, the technical way of writing Christians out of paganism. Then we talked about a more nuanced idea that somehow that Christianity is good enough for a Christian, good enough for a Gentile, good enough for the Goyim, or the idea that somehow Christians are fundamentally different because they have a God, they admit to God, they admit to many of our stories, as the Rambam says, and they practice an ethical life and practices, even despite the various atrocities that were committed in the name of Christianity or by Christians over the centuries. Then we said that in the 19th century we find some very liberal statements being made. We have we do have this bizarre idea that perhaps we do have some sort of a more mystical relationship to Jesus than one would think, and that there, to some degree we buy into this idea, or at least some people have through the centuries, and Maimonides included of all people, not just sort of Hasidim or mystics, but even Maimonides bought into this idea that somehow Christianity is part of the Jewish story. It was a road not taken, which was an important part of the Jewish story. And finally, we mentioned that right in there in our Shemoneh Esrei, we originally, in the early centuries, it was important enough, the war against early Christianity was important enough that it became a centerpiece, or Shemoneh Esrei, a touchstone of whether you were Jewish or you were a Jewish Christian, which would disqualify you to lead the services. So I hope that is a good overview of our relationship with Christianity. In terms of any evolving modern views, you had the most extreme view is expressed by Yitz Greenberg. He has some recent writings in which he allows for sort of other covenants, not necessarily a mainstream view. You have some Orthodox left-wing thinkers who like to think in terms of different covenants, that God could have different covenants. I don't know, I'm not so comfortable with it, but some people have made such arguments. But I think within the Meiri, you have a basis for viewing Christians as different than pagans. Today, this issue came to the fore when a certain rabbi, a friend of ours in New York, went to a event that took place, a national event that took place in a church in Washington. He went there for political reasons. And he used the Meiri as the basis, saying that this is not a pagan house of pagan. I didn't go into a house of paganism. I went into a place where they're involved in the ethical manners and practices of Judaism what's the word again? People who were fenced in the ways of religion and admit to a God. So using the Meiri, some people want to say that the previous prohibition of going into a house of heresy or a house of idol worship, such as the church, wouldn't apply because Meiri seems to take Christians out of that category. Other people say that doesn't say explicitly that he would permit going to a church, and that the Meiri is not the be-all and end-all of our views on Christianity, and most people seem to feel uncomfortable with it. So I think people are toying with the Meiri it's becoming more mainstream, but I don't know if it's really there yet. So we're still, pondering this idea of the Meiri. So so in the end, there is a certain coming to terms, both on the part of Maimonides and the part of the Meiri, that Christianity did bring a lot to the world that we believe in. The basic story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moses, Sinai, the Exodus from Egypt, all of our prophets, and that there's great value in that, and that they are practicing, in broad strokes, a form of ethical monotheism of sorts, and that should make us feel a little more comfortable in our surroundings. It's interesting that some of the people in our surroundings are more monotheistic, more polytheistic. Some of them view Jesus. Some are Trinitarian. Some view they're Unitarians. They only believe in Jesus. Jesus is God. All kinds of different Christian theologies. It's interesting to ponder them and how that would affect our view. Questions?
Is the word "goy" does that make Christian, or does that make any religion?
Yeah. So very interesting. When